This is continuing live courtroom coverage of the Take Care of Maya trial from the Hidden Killers podcast and True Crime Today.
Okay, the jury is out of our presence. Are there any issues that we need to address before we depart for our break?
Not for plaintiff.
Not for the defense.
Okay, when I come back, I'd like to have the time rundown for that depot, and I'll need the one for the next depot as well. 10-minute break.
Yep, thank you.
Okay, the got a note from the jury during videos. Is it okay to stand up to avoid drowsiness?
Yeah, we were going to address the same, Your Honor, that we're worried about the low lights contributing to the drowsiness.
Yeah, we're going to gently suggest that maybe not so dim.
The jury, what about me?
I'm half out of it already. Those were Mr. Whitney's questions. That's
That was very soothing.
You have a nice voice.
Anyway, we have no objection to the jury standing during it, whatever they needed to combat drowsiness and
jumping jack.
We'll defer to Your Honor whether maybe putting the lights on a little higher would help.
Well, what I will say is whether it's during the deposition, reading, or regular testimony, I'm fine with them standing there.
We are as well, Your Honor. And the next, just so Your Honor is aware, the next witness we're going to call by video as well will be Bonnie Rice. She runs about an hour and 15 minutes, so we'll go a little past five, but we'd like to use the day. Unless Your Honor has another preference.
We're going to finish the hour and 15-minute deposition. So what's the time charge for Dr. Behar-Posey?
She is charged 15 minutes and 50 seconds to the defense, 13 minutes, 5 seconds for the plaintiff, with 14 minutes, 42 seconds of overlap. Sorry, I should have rounded to 15 minutes.
Wait a second. Okay, so for plaintiff, how much was it?
For plaintiff, 13 minutes. Defense 16 minutes. I'm rounding up to the nearest minute. Defense 16 minutes. Plaintiff 13 minutes. Shared 15 minutes.
How did that end up getting attributed to us? We didn't call her.
Whatever pages you designate.
Oh, you're right.
Yeah.
Sorry.
Okay. And then for. Who's the next witness?
The next will be Bonnie Rice, advanced registered nurse practitioner, of which we designated 44 minutes. The plaintiff designated 34 minutes. The overlaps are 10 seconds. So.
So 35 and 45.
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay. And anything else before we bring in the jury?
No, Your Honor.
Okay, let's bring in the jury. Everyone. Members of the jury, I want to confirm while you were away, you did not discuss this case amongst yourselves. You did no investigation and did not receive any information. Is that correct?
Correct.
And have you been approached by anyone about this case? And have you seen any media accounts about this case? Okay. Now, I did receive a note from one of your numbers that reads, during videos, is it okay to stand up to avoid drowsiness? I will tell you this, whether it's during a deposition or if it's somebody on TV, if you would like to stand up and stretch for any reason, you are free to do that. So just go ahead and do it. Now, if you're in the front row and you're standing up, just kind of make sure you're not running into somebody and try not to block their views. Okay? You okay with that?
Yes.
Now, as far as the lighting is concerned, do you want me to turn on the tray light above you? The only thing is I don't have any control over dimming that. So that's the real bright one. So I can turn on, I think, this center light. You like it how it is? Okay. Leave it. No lullabies, right? Okay. Defense, call your next witness, please.
We call advanced registered nurse practitioner Bonnie Rice, also by video, Your Honor.
Ms. Rice, will you raise your right hand, please? Do you solemnly swear or affirm the testimony you're about to give today be the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth?
I do.
Bonnie, okay. Well, I'll keep it more, you know, Ms. Rice, or Dr. Rice. So can you please state your name and professional title for the record, please?
Sure. My name is Bonnie Rice, B-O-N-N-I-E, last name R-I-C-E, and my professional title is nurse practitioner.
So you were there when that rule change came in effect?
I think that, I'm not sure if it came, it was right as I left town and retired.
All right. Well, would you please give me the benefit of your training and experience in the field of being a nurse practitioner, starting from where you went to college, all the way through any training and professional licenses that you obtained?
Oh, well, let's see. I started as a diet aide in a hospital in 1973, and I've worked in some healthcare capacity since that time. I rode ambulance for 4 years as a volunteer. I was a nurse aide while I went through nursing school. I got my RN in 1983 from Harrisburg Area Community College. I received a bachelor's degree in nursing in 1996, and I got a I also had a minor in biology, and I had a master's degree in 1999, and then I finished my doctorate at Case Western Reserve in 2013. And I still have active licenses in California as both an ARNP and as a nurse, and maintain my family nurse practitioner certification, but I am not going to be working anymore.
So my understanding is the highest level of professional licensure you obtained was the Doctorate of Nursing.
Doctorate of Nursing Practice, it's known as a DNP. So when you're an ARNP, you can finish your doctorate and that gives you a DNP.
Can you talk to me a little bit about your experience as a pediatric rehabilitation NP?
Okay, so when I initially came to the rehab program, I had had about, 12 years experience, but I had pediatric experience starting in 1991, and I was certified at that time in pediatric critical care. When I came to Tampa General, I realized that that was somewhat of a new position, so I obtained a certification in rehab nursing to make sure that my knowledge level was documented regarding rehabilitative medicine in children.
So what kind of courses or hands-on training did you do in order to get this pediatric rehabilitation licensure?
It's not really a license, it's a certification. And basically Dr. Kornberg, I made rounds with him every single day doing the exams. You know, when you're working as an ARNP for a physician or for the hospital, but you're primarily responsible to one physician, you follow their practice patterns, you learn their rules because you're very much an extension of them.
How long did you work with Dr. Kornberg?
12 years.
What else do you recall independent of anything you may have reviewed about the hospitalization?
It was a, you know, I think rehab is very much about this multidisciplinary team. And I have to say that this was a frustrating case for the team. That's what I remember.
And why was it a frustrating case for the team?
Because I didn't, even though Maya was making functional progress, I didn't feel that we had gotten through to the family or that we'd helped the family. And I just felt like the mother and the daughter, they just weren't open.
What do you mean by that?
Every day when I would make rounds, part of my responsibility is to educate on what, to make families aware of what the child's deficits are and what the potential issues could be and how we may compensate for that. And then towards the end of the admission, if there's something that we can't compensate for, we want them to accept that the child may have an ongoing special need. Yeah, and I just felt like I couldn't move this family at all.
What do you mean by couldn't move this family?
I couldn't move them down their road of recovery, which is a road that, being a nurse, I kind of help patients through that road of recovery, and we do long-term follow-up. So we stay with these families even after they're discharged to make sure they get reintegrated to school, they have the appropriate equipment in the house, they have appropriate transportation, all that type of thing. So it's sort of like not a medical admission where we're working up medical things. We can do that, but as a rule, we didn't. We tried to move the patient from being a patient to being a child in society, back in the community.
Let me ask you this. Do you have any experience back when you were at Tampa General with treating children that are diagnosed with complex regional pain syndrome?
Yes.
Can you just generally describe what your experience with complex regional pain syndromes was back when you were working at TGH?
I think we had one or two children in the 12 years I was there that came in with complex regional pain syndrome. And really, I looked to Dr. Kornberg to lead the medical part of it, but it's where you have unexplained pain in one area or another that we can't find a physiologic cause for, or sometimes there could have been a cause and it's just pain that lasts longer than normal, right? That would fall outside of the normal pattern.
Did you ever, while at TGH, in connection with a complex regional pain syndrome patient, ever do what's known as a ketamine coma at Tampa General?
No.
Do you know what a ketamine coma is?
Yes.
Do you understand what is it?
It's an infusion of ketamine. But, you know, I have to tell you that for my time at Tampa General, ketamine was a very tightly controlled drug and wasn't even allowed to be used on the floor where we were. I know that they were using ketamine now in a number of different ways, but it's all new since 2015.
Are you familiar with the Dr. Anthony Kirkpatrick? He used to be on staff at Tampa General. Do you know who that is?
I don't recognize the name.
It has been suggested in a blog entry by Beata Kowalski that you were practicing witchcraft on Maya Kowalski at Tampa General Hospital. Were you practicing witchcraft in connection with Maya Kowalski?
No, I'm not a witch, and I don't practice witchcraft. I don't even believe in witchcraft. I'm a scientist.
Understood. And it's fair to say that you were using evidence-based practices in your treatment of Maya Kowalski?
Absolutely. The only thing that we had that was, it was a consult to integrative medicine. We did have a team there at Tampa General that would do things like Reiki massage, aromatherapy. We did some disability yoga, breathing exercises. So we had consulted them just to see if they could help with Maya's complaints of pain.
Can you please describe what your independent recollection is?
Okay. So, like I said, my job was, it was kind of to be that holistic person and lead them down. Usually, you know, it's a road of grief, of accepting that maybe their child was in an accident, maybe other people were killed or whatever. So we're on this sort of grief and coping road together.
Do you have any personal animosity towards Mrs. Kowalski?
Absolutely not. I tried to connect with her in every way I could think. And our joke in rehab was, we'll try 1,000 different things to get kids moving again. And I think I Dr. McCain and I talked about this, Mom, almost every day because I felt like I couldn't connect. And I couldn't sway her perception of reality.
What do you mean by perception of reality?
She was hyper-focused on medical tests and treatments, and the team felt that the child's problems had a very heavy psychological and psychiatric overlay.
Okay, what is a history and physical?
A history and physical, when the patient first comes in, you want to find out, you have usually records from the referring hospital. We were a referral service, so people referred into us. You have some records from the referring hospital, and then you go in and question both. I admitted the family as a unit. There are discharge plan, there, how this kid's going to go home. And we've all got to, you know, cope together and move forward, and they needed to learn what they needed to learn and be able to cope with that. And so I would start right away trying to form a relationship with the child, the family. And I remember this kid came in with her father, and okay. He was a very good historian. He had medical background too.
You recall what his medical background was?
Something in first responder, EMT, paramedic, firefighter, something.
Who was the referring physician for this hospitalization?
It was Dr. Hart. We worked very closely with him.
Okay, and Dr. Hart, I think you said, is a pediatric physiatrist over at All Children's Hospital?
All Children's, yes.
Okay. And what was the estimated stay for this hospitalization, as best you can tell from the HMP?
Oh, heavens, we estimated 4 to 6 weeks.
Okay, and is that where it says ELOS, estimated 4 to 6 weeks?
Yes, and so because we're a functional admission, these children would not be in the hospital if they weren't there to make functional gains, as a rule. Not always, but as a rule. So, you know, you can sign out at any time. It's not like a regular hospitalization. We're helping you to walk and take care of yourself and go to the bathroom on your own and feed yourself. And if there's a mental disability or a speech issue or swallowing issue, we would get speech involved. And so you can sign out at any time. And so we want to make sure that the family understands what our length of stays might look like. However, this occurs before the 48 hours of evaluation that occurs by the therapy team. In that first 48 hours, everybody on the team sees this child, evaluates the child from their perspective. So each person would evaluate the child from their perspective, and then we'd bring it back and change the plan of care accordingly.
What's your recollection of any discussions that you had with Dr. Kornberg about this patient?
We talked on a daily basis. I let him know that from my holistic standpoint, in terms of her, the mother and the child, that I felt we weren't connecting. We weren't being therapeutic. There was just a wall there.
What was Dr. Kornberg's position on this?
I don't think he felt it quite like I do, because I'm a nurse, right? So we were empaths, he had some of the same concerns, and the team all shared and discussed our concerns.
I noticed yes. You used the term team a few times. So do you consider this to be a team approach to what you guys were doing at the TGH?
Yes, the main thing for conversion disorder or any rehabilitative patient, like I said, it's not really a medical admission. We can do medicine, and we do medicine, but it's all about the functionality of the child, and that requires a multidisciplinary team of really talented people that are evaluating this kid every single day and communicating. And we just had a tremendous team at that time, and I know the team expressed frustrations that we were getting Maya more functional. She was moving forward in a functional realm, but we didn't feel that that was something that was going to be able to be maintained.
What is the significance of a normal CPK finding as referenced here on the H&P that you draft?
It may mean that it's not a steroid myopathy and there may be some other pathology going on.
What is your recollection of Maya's asthma status during the period of time she was at Tampa General?
I felt she was stable from an asthma standpoint. We were not escalating medical therapy or treatments.
My understanding too was that prior to coming to Tampa General, my wife was admitted to Lurie Children's Hospital in Chicago. Do you know anything about that hospitalization?
Yeah, that was another full workup for a second opinion. She had a primary, dad had worked in Chicago. They had a primary care physician in Chicago, and they wanted the workup done there just to kind of verify everything that All Children's was telling them, I guess. I don't know.
Did you ever see any of the records from Lurie Children's Hospital?
The family did bring in the records, and eventually Dr. Kornberg was able to get the disc open and reviewed all the records and said it was a comprehensive workup.
Let's walk through more of this now. When Maya presented, what was her ambulatory status?
She was not ambulating. She was being carried to the bathroom by her father.
How would she get around upon presentation?
Yes, so she didn't leave her bed.
Okay. It says here she uses her wheelchair as her primary mode of locomotion.
Oh, yes. If she went, if she was going to the playroom or some or the gym, she would go in a wheelchair.
I probably should have recalled this, asked this earlier, but what do you recall about Maya from a personality standpoint based on your interactions with her?
So she was sweet. She was interactive. She was pleasant until the physical exam, and then it would just rapidly deteriorate. There would be whimpering and crying, some screaming. As soon as you went to examine her, there was it seemed like she was resistant to the exam or upset by the exam. I don't know.
And then the next line, Nurse Rice says, she adjusts arms and legs for comfort and wipes her own tears away with her right hand. Why is that something that you put in the H&P?
Because, you know, she was not feeding herself. Her mother was feeding her. And I didn't know this until after the H&P, but, you know, we're going to write down every single type of movement we see so that we can work with what we have. And that's part of my assessment. So that's why it was so specific. But I have to say that my interactions and observations of her were not consistent with what her dad was telling me about her dependency.
So after engaging in those, it says here, she, quote, she stopped crying and stated, quote, I don't distract easily, end quote, and then commenced crying. Do you see that line?
Uh-huh.
Why is it that you included that in your H&P?
Yeah, so that's unusual, you know, that she, first of all, that a fourth grader would know what distraction was and that she doesn't distract easily is, you know, she was a very smart little girl. And so I felt that was just something just that I hadn't seen in children before, just this stopping of the crying and then making a statement. Because usually when people are in tremendous pain, they're whimpering and they're not, they might get angry, but they certainly don't stop and say, the technique you're using isn't going to work.
Okay.
And I just hadn't had that from a child before.
And then under neuro, and I imagine that's neurological, correct?
Yeah.
It says she has pain everywhere, cannot describe pain. Why did you include that in the H&P?
Well, normally we want to know all about the pain. We want to know the onset. We want to know the location. We want to know, you know, how long have you had it? What's an aggravating factor? This is part of how we're going to treat her pain if pain ends up being her primary symptom.
And up to the point that you were treating Maya Kowalski as of 2015, how many years had you been working in the pediatric nurse practitioner physiatry realm?
Let's see, probably 7 or 8.
Okay, can you approximate how many patients that you saw in your TGH unit with Dr. Kornberg over those several years?
Probably close to 500. You know, do you have it worse in the morning? I have it all the time. And so then I would say, well, where is it on your head? You know, you're trying to figure out
Okay. What's
going on. She came in with this history of steroid-induced myopathy, and that was per the father's report. And I knew she had been seen by endocrinology over at All Children's and had been on a steroid wean. So that's our number one thing, because we're either trying to confirm that or move on to another possibility. She was not walking, so that gives her gait disorder. Impaired mobility and ADLs is what the occupational therapies do. That's activities of daily living. They're going to teach her to bathe herself, brush her own teeth, clothe herself, that type of thing. And they'll even get memory. They'll do some memory type things. And then her asthma, we were actively treating for that, so I wanted to list that. Myalgia means muscle pain. Myalgia means pain in the muscles. Myositis can mean inflammation in the muscles, although we didn't have any objective findings that we could say that there was inflammation. There certainly wasn't any redness or swelling or anything like that. She had no fever. There was no sign of inflammation, really. But we also were trying to get her communion, I remember, because her mother was Catholic. And we'll do... We'll try and heal the entire person, mind, body, spirit. So integrative medicine, like one of the things we were trying to work with her on is just saying, I can, or I'll try, instead of I can't. because she would just scream, "I can't do it." And we wanted her to try. You know, you have to use a muscle to make it stronger, is what we would tell her.
Do you have any other experiences or observations that were similar to what Dr. Kornberg noted there?
Yes, but this was very common for Maya. When her mother was in the room, she would, and sometimes her dad, but mostly her mother, she would just stop functioning. And she would not, you could see her doing things that indicated she had the muscle capability to do these things. And then when you, you know, went to examine her or tried to motivate her to do something, she would use the crying and tears, and we felt there was probably a huge psychological, psychiatric overlay there.
Okay, all right.
Although we did treat her pain. We did treat the pain.
So we walked through the physical exam, we walked through your H&P. Is there anything that as we walked through the H&P that triggered a recollection or a memory of your time with either Maya or her parents that we haven't discussed?
Yes, yeah, so I don't know exactly. You know, Maya is a very smart little girl. And I don't know if she had seen a disabled kid in the past and seen how they posture when they're spastic. But when we would try to work with her, she would assume this classic spastic pose in both her hands and her legs. And she would say, I can't do this. I just can't do it. My legs don't move. I can't do it. And yet when she was up in the bed, I could see her moving her legs just fine, rubbing up against the covers, not having pain, you know, so it was very puzzling, very, very puzzling.
What do you mean by spastic?
Yeah, so we're the experts at muscle motor movement, disability. Spastic is something that happens usually after a central nervous system injury, where the muscles, it's very complicated, and I'm not sure science completely understands it, but your feedback mechanism for muscles to relax is shut off. So you end up being, your body starts to twist into certain shapes, and your muscles will naturally do that, and all the spastic kids have very similar problems. Versus a dystonia, and I know that's in the chart too, that's where your limb is basically frozen like a statue into a spastic position. Most kids that we dealt with were on a trajectory. They would get on like a recovery trajectory, and so you sort of knew what to expect. Now, would they surprise you all the time? But, you know, you kind of 80% of, like Pareto principle, 80% of the kids did usually this trajectory. So they would get on a recovery trajectory, and we could kind of tell how far they were going to go as an inpatient, what we could accomplish, and then what their outpatient therapy plans would look like. She actually had some friends, all the rehab kids do stuff together. And she had one little boy in particular that she was good friends with, and her function would just, you know, go back to being a normal muscle movement.
Okay.
When she was with him.
Is it fair to say that Maya's functionality at times would vary depending on who was around?
Absolutely.
Okay, why don't you explain that a little bit more for me?
So when her mother would enter the room, it just became kind of a battle of the wills between the two of them. I mean, it was the weirdest, one of the weirdest mother-daughter dyads I've ever seen in my life. I'm not sure we helped this family to get Maya back to her healthiest state. But it became pretty clear over the course of everything that they would, it was kind of like being in the middle of a tug of war. They weren't actively arguing with each other. As a matter of fact, they showed kind of indifference to each other. But if mother would say, we need to get her back to her skating or swimming or whatever extracurricular activities, Maya would just look at me, not her mother, and say, I'm not going to be doing that. You know, so there was this like battle of the wills. I'm not a psychologist. That's why I talked to Dr. McCain so many times, because I didn't know where to go next.
And then so in one of her notes, it's at TGH 42 to 47. It says that at one point in Nurse Hussey's exam, it was noted that Maya could stretch her legs and arms, and she appeared to do so with ease. But later on in the examination, she wasn't able to move her fingers to grip my hand and refused to use her arms and legs to evaluate range of motion and strength. And I know that was obviously Nurse Hussey's observation, but did you have any similar interactions similar to that with Maya?
Every day.
Every day from that whole month?
Pretty much, yeah. I mean, we would take her to therapies, and if her mother was present, she would just deteriorate. And that was why the team was so concerned, because we can get you functional again, but if we send you back into a home where you're with your parents and you're just going to deteriorate, that isn't really functional gain, is it?
As somebody who's working with these kids, why is it significant to you that a patient may be able to do some things with ease during an examination and then not be able to do other things with ease in that same examination?
It seemed like she might be using her dependency to get her parents' attention.
And was that something you discussed with the neuropsychologist?
Oh, yes. And psychiatry. We had psychiatry.
I think you said that Dr. McCain was able to put a finger on it, I think you said, correct?
I'm not sure if she did or not. I knew that we were, towards the end of her hospitalization, we were feeling like what we provide at pediatric rehab was not what Maya needed.
Okay.
Maya and her mother needed. Yes, and that's actually, like I said, we use a scoring system, and she was making gains. It's just that the gains were not permanent.
And why was that concerning to you as an NP that deals with pediatric pain patients?
Well, because I started to think that pain was not my specialty, and we had special pain nurses that just did pain. But we always treat pain before function. If you hurt a kid, you'll never get them down to the gym again. So you have to make sure that they're pain-free before you, or at least pain reduced before you start treatment. So I'm sorry.
Okay. Later on in Dr. Bijapura's note, he indicates that when he suggested about playing the keyboard or doing puzzles, that Maya responded, "I can't do anything with my hands." And yet Dr. Bijapura would note that throughout his interview, the patient would be able to pick up objects and adjust her blanket. I guess my question is Dr. Bijapura's observation of those activities consistent with what you observed throughout your time with Maya Kowalski?
Yes, it is.
And how would you describe that similarity?
She could function, you know, when she was doing an activity that she enjoyed and her mother wasn't in the room, she would paint her nails and do other fine motor. I can't even paint my own nails. Fine motor tasks she could do. And she was a very skillful artist. And yet when her mother would walk in, she would hold her hands like this and say, "You have to feed me."
And then later on in this same note from August 5th, it indicates that Maya was functionally worse across all domains with mother present and assisting. What does that mean?
That means her mother was in the room and her function deteriorated. I think they had been trying to treat her complaints of pain, which is, we always defer to kids, you know, if they say they have pain, they have pain. But because she was reporting high pain scores on all these narcotics, it didn't seem to me like, or to Dr. Kornberg or Karen Hussey, that the pain was in the pathway that can be treated with narcotics. Okay. So there's multiple kind of pain pathways. And we thought maybe it was neuropathic pain, which is generated differently than pain via the mu receptors.
In this note, it indicates that Maya's complaints of pain have escalated when her mother's bedside. Again, what is the significance of that entry?
And it became really clear after 30 days that when her mother was there, her function would deteriorate. Yeah.
And it says again here that mom was requesting oxycodone specifically. Do you see that?
Yes. She was a nurse. She was very smart.
Okay. In this same note, you indicate here that Maya was observed smiling in the gym and interacting in the gym until mother arrived and Maya began moaning and began leaning laterally, but flexed elbows with hands in place. Can you please explain what that line means?
It means she was assuming a posture when her mother came in the room.
You voluntarily doing that?
She was, in my belief and my exams, we know when it's volitional muscle movement.
Understood. Okay. And in this same note, it also indicates that Maya has increased physical symptomatology with her mother rooming in. Explain what that line means. There's some technical jargon in there.
Yeah, so the pattern became clear over time that her mother would come in and there would just be this sort of a deterioration of the whole environment. I mean, going in there was awkward. It was confrontational. As soon as her mother would come in, very little therapeutic activity would occur. And her mom was a nurse and she would set up an office. So she would be on the other bed. We always have our parents. We try to have them rooming in so they can learn all the things, not just come in, you know, once and learn about a therapy session. We want them in therapy, seeing what we're doing so that they can continue that therapeutic environment into the home. But her mom would come down to the gym and set up an office. She'd have her laptop there, her cell phone. And I know that at least one occasion I heard Maya complain that her mother was always working and didn't pay attention to her was the implication.
And why is that something that stands out?
Because it seemed like she was seeking attention through dependency. And that confirmed that to some, on some level.
Looking forward to an August 10, 2015 note that you offered along with Dr. Kornberg. That's at 3:10. In that note, there's a reference to mom being resistant to medication reduction. Do you have any recollection about that?
One of the weaning schedules, the mother got very upset because she noticed that the syringe had less medication than the time before, which is something that happens when you're stepping down dose. So I know I had talked to her about stepping down the narcotics and benzos, but then this was a couple days later and she was like, why is her dose lower? I do have to tell you that we don't go in and tell the kid every day, we're going to lower your dose. Because if you do that, you can set them up for thinking, okay, I have less painkiller, I have more pain. So we just kind of wean the dose down and then we observe and frequently assess your pain and see what happens. And in fact, her pain wasn't exacerbated as we weaned off the narcotics.
Okay, yeah, it says in your note here that when not focused on functional tasks, Maya moves her BLEs into various positions for comfort and uses upper extremity to position for comfort in the wheelchair. What is that entry in your note describing?
Normal function that you would see in a child. She would have times where she would have absolutely normal function of her arms and legs.
Then I'll move forward to August 12, 2015 note. It indicates that Maya was in good spirits when playing on her iPad. Do you have any recollection of Maya being in good spirits during the time that you cared for her?
Yeah, she made a friend with a little boy down the hall who we called our mayor. He had multiple admissions and he loved coming to the program because we do a lot of fun stuff on PD rehab. But when she was with this little boy, it was great. They would watch movies at night together and she was a happy kid.
And in that same note under MSK, it indicates that Maya continues to hold her feet in plantar flexion and inversion whenever examined. What does that describe?
Yeah, so it's just the pointed toe and the pointed toe slightly going in. So you have, these aren't feet, but just imagine the toes are pointed. They start to slightly go in. And when we observed that, there was, I remember, a really big discussion about whether to put her in braces or not.
I look, ma'am, there's been Kornberg threatened to break Maya's ankles. Do you recall Dr. Kornberg ever saying that?
No.
Have you ever seen or heard Dr. Kornberg threaten a patient in that way?
No. Dr. Kornberg is the sweetest doctor I ever worked with. He was all about the kids. He would never, ever do anything to harm a child.
Moving forward, August 13, now 2015, TGH 254 to 256. This is also a note authored by yourself and Dr. Kornberg. There's a reference in that note about mom having a phone conversation about Maya needing IVIG per a therapist's report. Do you recall any Maya Kowalski's mother addressing the need for IVIG?
Yes. Yeah, so, you know, I think she was desperate to find a medical cause and treat medical causes, because I don't think the mom could wrap her head around the fact that her daughter had, you know, this cute, charming, fantastic little girl had serious psychiatric problems, serious psychiatric and psychological problems that probably warranted an inpatient psych stay.
In that same note, there is a reference to the feet being pointed into aquinovarus. What is that?
That's just a way of describing that they're plantar flexed and inverted in one term.
In that same note, it also says, but noted to intermittently actively dorsiflex. So I guess my question is, when it says here, feet pointed into aquinovirus, but noted to intermittently actively dorsiflex, what are you explaining there in your note?
That the leg was not contracted, that she was easily able to move her feet into a functional position of 90 degrees.
Okay. Yeah. Later on in that same note, it indicates that it appears as if Maya had been actively posturing ankles into aquinovirus.
Varus.
What is that describing?
It means that she's volitionally putting her feet like that.
And then I believe there, at some point, around the middle of this hospitalization, Mrs. Kowalski wanted some input with a pediatric neurologist. Do you recall that?
I do.
Now, I've seen reference in the chart on a couple of notes to a Maria Gieron-Corfalls. Who is
that's Maria? That's the neurologist. Okay. Yeah.
And is that Maria? Is that Dr. Gieron-Corfalls? Am I saying that properly?
Mm-hmm. Yes. Okay.
Is she a pediatric neurologist?
She is.
You got a chance to review the TGH chart, right?
Yes, I have.
Do you recall if Dr. Gieron-Corfalls interacted with Maya Kowalski?
Yes.
Do you recall what the opinion of pediatric neurology was with respect to Maya Kowalski?
Yes. She tell you what she said, and I know this is hearsay, but she stopped by my office and said that little girl's faking it.
What was your response to Dr. Maria Gieron-Corfalls during this conversation?
Are we sure? And is there any other thing that we need to do to make sure? Because you always want to give the kids the benefit of the doubt, right? And I do that for the parents, too. You know, nobody's on their best behavior when their kid's in a pediatric floor in the hospital. Nobody. I expect abnormal behaviors, and that's just something that we handle. Yeah.
Okay. Do you recall anything else from this interaction with the pediatric neurologist?
Yeah, you know, I thought it's, well, I asked her if there were any other tests, what else we should do, that type of thing. And I asked her not to confront, I asked her not to confront conversion patients, telling them that their situation isn't real. Because when you do that, they'll dig their heels in and they will not get better. They'll do anything under the sun to prove to you that they are really disabled. And it sets up, like I said, what we used was boundaries and positive reinforcement. So we only say, yes, you did that, you did that. If she says, but I can't do this, you just ignore that and move forward into another activity and keep it positive and sort of ignore the disability and they get better.
You referenced a couple of diagnostic studies there in conjunction with this pediatric neurologist. I've seen reference to an EMG and nerve conduction study in the chart. Mm-hmm. I saw a reference to the fact that Maya didn't have any discomfort when she was pricked for those studies. Did you see any documentation to that effect?
Yes.
Okay. And what is the significance of that in your opinion?
I don't know why I've had an EMG. They're painful. I don't know why she didn't respond.
I guess my question for you is, as this hospitalization moved forward, did you notice any differences between how Maya would behave when dad was around versus when mom was around?
Yes, we felt that her function didn't deteriorate as much with the father there, although she still had a lot of dependency and still wanted him to perform a lot of her activities of daily living for her. But when mom was there, she would just completely deteriorate. Therapeutic intervention wasn't even possible. It was just awkward.
And according to this note, it's August 20, 2015. It can be found at TGH 158. It looks like you met with Mrs. Kowalski, Maya's mother, along with Dr. Vijayakura. You see that note?
I remember the meeting.
Oh, okay, well, that was my first question. Why don't you explain to me what you recall about that meeting?
Yeah, so we frequently do, well, everybody gets family meetings to let them know how their kids are doing and also to assess how the parent is coping with the kids' progress. And in this particular case, I had asked Dr. Vijayakura if we could have a family meeting with this mom because I didn't feel like she was receptive to information from me. I just wasn't connecting with her somehow. And so I asked Dr. He's a very kind guy. And I thought maybe he could say some things and she would respect his credentials more. Because as a nurse, I'm sure she's thinking, you know, this lady's just a nurse. I'd rather hear from a doctor. And I've bumped into that before. It didn't bother me at all. And I thought if Dr. Vijayakura told her what the situation was, maybe she could wrap her head around that.
Okay. And what situation are you describing specifically?
That this may be dependency that is related to psychological and psychiatric factors.
Nurse Rice, in this note, it indicates that Dr. Vijayakura explained to Maya's mother that Maya's progress was slower than expected and seemed to regress in the presence of her mother. Can you explain what that means?
Well, just as I was describing earlier, her mother would come in and then therapeutic intervention would kind of stop because, you know, her symptoms would all be exacerbated. She wasn't willing to participate So I had talked to Dr. Vijayakura and we had agreed that maybe if we had a small trial of mom not being rooming in, and I have to say it's the only time I think I ever asked a mom not to room in, that we could see an improvement in her function. And in fact, we did.
Okay. Well, I wanted to ask about that. So it looks like mom was agreeable to reduce her presence to see if it would help, right?
Yeah. So I don't think she was happy about it, but she agreed.
And what did you see after mom left for a bit?
Things normalized. It just seemed like mother-child were in some kind of a battle of the wills. That's just what it seemed like every time he went in. And so when the mother was not there, that wasn't present. And okay. Therapy could continue.
Do you agree or disagree with Mrs. Kowalski's contention that Maya was doing better when her mother was present?
I disagree.
Why do you disagree?
From observation and correlation.
What was Dr. Vijayakura's position on this?
Well, so Dr. Vijayakura is a psychiatrist, right? So he doesn't, I mean, he's a medical doctor, but his concern was not her function per se. His concern was what's going on from a psychiatric standpoint. So it was a little bit different.
Did he think that Maya would benefit with mom not being around?
He asked mom to give us a couple days to see how things would be different.
Here, it indicates that Maya had some complaints of blurry vision. Do you have any recollection of Maya's complaints of blurry vision about 20 days into this hospitalization?
Yes. So once her mother left, she seemed to do better. But when her mother returned, she had a number of complaints. And one of them was that she had, her mother had observed an eye twitch and she had reported blurry vision in her right eye.
What steps?
Pretty sure it was the right eye.
Can you please explain what you were describing there in your note, ma'am?
Yeah, so, you know, once we had worked with her for a while, you know, the exams were just so inconsistent. Muscle improvement occurs in a specific way. And there isn't any disorder that I know of where you can be absolutely normal 1 minute and then completely disabled the next. And that's what we were seeing all the time. You know, it wasn't this progression of this muscle getting stronger, 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 or this muscle getting a little weaker. It was this absolute change in function from a very low functional independence measure to a very high functional independence measure, depending on the situation.
Now, later on in this note, under psychiatry, it says recommended reducing parental presence to see if this affects Maya's progress. Is that a reference to what we were talking about earlier about not having mom room in?
Yes, and that's why I had Dr. Vijapura tell her, because I felt like I said, she didn't really recognize any expertise on my part, and that's okay. That's okay. But I thought if somebody was a doctor and sat down with her and specifically in what we thought the problem was with this child, maybe he could break through to her.
Let me ask you this. You've had a chance to review the 820.
Can we stop the playing and approach?
More live courtroom coverage of the Take Care of Maya trial from the Hidden Killers podcast and True Crime Today is coming up. Press subscribe now.